Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to Filibuster here on the Nerd Party Network. Joining me to discuss Season 1 of Star Trek Picard is the emergency Star Trek super nerd hologram, Trek News writer Carlos Miranda. Carlos, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Lee. It's a pleasure to be back.
And joining me again as well is emergency author and Star Trek intellect, Duncan Barrett. Welcome back, Duncan.
Hi, Lee. Good to be here.
Yeah, last time you were on the show, you were the subject of an interview as well, so it's a nice little kind of change to have you as a co-host on this one, Duncan.
That's true. I'm putting on a different hat this time, I guess.
Exactly. We moved from child...
I was going to say, he has a goatee this time, so he's like mirror Star Trek intellect.
Exactly. Yeah,
this is my lockdown beard, you know. Yeah. Wait and see what it'll be like in 2 months'
time. That's pretty sad if that's your lockdown beard, let's be honest.
Hey, we're only a week in.
Nah, all right. That's a lot more Thomas Riker than Will Riker. Let's
right.
put it that way.
So before we dive into our thoughts, let's go back to the UK premiere of Star Trek Picard, where I spoke with the cast and crew of the series on the red carpet. Here's a wee throwback to those interviews. We're joined by Jeri Ryan, Michelle Hurd, Issa Bryans, Jonathan DeLarco, Michael Chabon, Kristen Beyer, and Jason Isaacs. First up, I'm joined by Jeri Ryan, who returns to the iconic role of Seven of Nine.
Jeri, what was that phone call like when they call you up to say we want you to come back? Was it one of excitement, nerves, get lost? How did you feel?
My experience was a little different. I heard about this first 2 years ago at the Hollywood Bowl, drinking champagne with a friend of mine, as we do in the summers. And about two or three glasses into the evening, he decided to say, okay, here's what I'm thinking. I want to bring Seven back. And I laughed and said, you know, it's funny, it's really funny. And he said, no, I'm serious, here's what I'm thinking. And he pitched me sort of the ideas that they were thinking of what she would be like now. And it was honestly really intriguing. But I didn't think anything was going to come of it because people pitch ideas in Hollywood all the time and nothing happens. Cut to Creative Arts Emmys last year. I'm lined up backstage to go on for Star Trek to get an award. I'm behind Alex Kurtzman. And he said, oh, yeah, I understand you talked to James. Yeah, we've been talking a lot about Seven in the writer's room. I was like, you're actually doing this? I had no idea. So it's pretty cool.
Good to have you back.
Thank you.
Michelle Hurd joins the Star Trek franchise as a former Starfleet officer, Raffi, who works alongside Admiral Picard during the Romulan supernova crisis, and years later, the events of Star Trek Picard brings them back together.
How does it feel to join a lineage of multiracial characters, you know, Nichelle Nichols, so many other great names? How does it feel to be part of that legacy of a Star Trek and kind of this, you know, diversity that Star Trek's so proud of?
Well, when I got this job, I'm biracial. My father is black man, my mother's white. He was an actor, and when we were growing up, it was really important for him that there's three girls in the family, that his daughters would see themselves represented. The only show that my family would sit down and watch was Star Trek.
That's amazing.
The first interracial kiss was on Star Trek. As a biracial child, that was the first time I got to see someone telling the story of my parents, the first time. And when I got this job and I had that flashback, I didn't realize how important that moment, that scene, seeing that kind of inclusion was to a child. So all I can think of now in this moment, when I think of Issa Bryans and myself, Eurasian, biracial, we're creating that mirror for all these other children that may not have seen themselves. I mean, it's a huge, amazing responsibility. I love Star Trek that it has always done that. It's always been about diversity. It's always been about inclusion. And not sort of saying like, oh, you know, you can be black because we're in Africa. It's the world. So yes, I love that you asked that question because it literally is one of the major things that I'm so excited and so honored that I get to do for some other little curly-haired beige monster.
So thank you very much and welcome to
Absolutely.
The Star Trek
fan. Thank you.
Issa Bryans is the mysterious Dash, a young woman who seeks Picard's help.
How does it feel to be cast in such a mysterious role that you can't talk about, no one has a clue about? How does it feel to be there? What's the pros and cons of that for you?
Well, as much as it's driving everyone else crazy that I can't talk about it, it's driving me just as crazy, because I wish I could talk about this amazing character. But, I mean, the cool thing is that we get to... What I love is that the show is not being dropped all at once. It gets to be revealed, so people get to get a very exciting, slow reveal of what this mysterious girl is, who she could possibly be, and what is she up to.
Did you enjoy all the speculation about your character? Did you dip into that and take a look?
I haven't looked, but my friends and family have told me, and they're like telling me all the theories, and it's fun to sit there and be like, oh, that person's onto it, oh, that person's way off. Oh,
so people have guessed it. Some people have guessed it.
You know, some people are on
Were you a fan of science fiction as a kid? Did you grow up watching Star Trek?
I didn't. Unfortunately, I didn't grow up watching Star Trek, and I am kicking myself about it, because going back, once I got the show, I went back, and since there's so many seasons of Next Generation, I was like, okay, first I'll just bop around to like the episodes that pertain to my character. I was like reading the descriptions of everything, and then I got to a certain point, season 4, and I just got hooked, and I just kept watching, and have become a much bigger fan than I ever knew I was going to be.
Did it make it slightly less daunting interviewing for the role before you knew how iconic the series was?
Well, the thing is, you always know that Star Trek is this iconic series. Even if you haven't watched it, you are aware of that, because, I mean, Trekkies invented fandom. You know that is what you're getting yourself into, but the amazing thing is getting to meet the fans and getting to see just how much love is there. That's like the only word I can use to describe it, because everyone has they don't know what our characters are. They've never met us, but they still are giving us so much love and support already without even knowing who we are.
The whole feature in the series, I just wonder, what do you make of our relationship with technology? Because in the series, of course, it feels a bunch sort of disconnected from the cube, like the cubes. How do you think we are dealing with our sort of relationship with technology?
Well, I think what's so great about Star Trek in general and this show is showing that the dynamic of here's the pros, here are the cons, let's let you decide, see where you lie, because obviously we've seen with the Borg cube that technology can be really dangerous. Technology can take a turn on us, but we've also seen the pros, we've seen the data, we've seen the, and so it's really what the show does is present all the ideas to you and goes, you decide.
What were the highlights of your experience shooting Star Trek along with like new characters, old characters? What have been the highlights for you?
I think anytime all of us were working together, like Michelle, Allison, Santiago, and Patrick, when we were all there, those are always my favorite days on set. We've gotten so close over the course of filming, and it's really become a family. And we goof off way too much and have far too much fun, but it makes going to work not work.
Perfect. Good luck.
Thank you.
Jonathan DeLarco, last seen in TNG Season 7, is back again as Hugh.
Jonathan, welcome back. I watched Descent Part 2 again earlier, and it ended on a note of, I wonder what will happen next, where you will go, maybe there's already a leader. How did it feel decades later to receive this phone call to pose what's going to happen next to that character?
I actually, it wasn't a call, it was over drinks with a friend at a concert. But I was in disbelief, honestly, that it would ever happen. But when it did, I was very, very happy. Very, very excited. And, of course, the day I got to reunite with Patrick with Picard, it was a very emotional moment, you know, to get to see the two characters to meet back up again after that last, we hadn't seen each other since that last moment. He said, I think you're a leader, right? So
well, it's good to have you back.
Thank you.
Series creators Michael Chabon and Kristen Beyer talk with me about the making of the latest Star Trek series.
Hi there, Michael, absolute pleasure to talk with you. Is it a bittersweet or excited feeling? You've done the first season, you're moving on in the second one to be here at the premiere. And
it's just exciting, and I mean, it's a relief, actually, to finally get to this point. We were working on this, Kirsten Meyer, with other producers and writers on the show. It's been a long journey for us, even longer than it has for any of the actors right now, except maybe Patrick. And to be here tonight is just, it's exciting, though, that people are going to get a chance to see it.
And for yourself, you've written books, you've got a huge involvement with Star Trek. What's it like to be here at the premiere of an event, one that you've been able to put your hands on so early on?
It's completely surreal. You imagine a moment like this, but you never let yourself think it could actually happen. I'm still not sure it's happening, It's incredible.
What's it like to create a Star Trek series from the ground up?
So much fun. So much fun. It's just...
We call it work, but we call it,
exactly.
We're really
playing. I mean, we love this stuff, and just sitting down at the keyboard and typing the words, they step onto the transporter pad and dematerialize or whatever, just like, I can't believe I get to type those words.
How does your literary background kind of prepare you for TV writing? Is it quite the crossover, or is it more challenging writing novels, perhaps?
I think the fact that storytelling is serialized now means that as novelists, we're sort of uniquely well-prepared to tackle stories of that scope.
Yeah, but the collaborative part of it is what's the big difference. You know, when you're writing a book, you sit by yourself in a room with the door shut in your pajamas.
Yeah.
And, nobody really cares if you show up for work that day. And... with this, we're all in it together, we're obligated to each other, and also we have a lot of fun. It's a nice change. I've been writing books for a long time, all by myself. Kirsten and Akiva and Alex and everybody else is supporting.
Was there anything you couldn't be too precious about that you maybe wrote in sort of these Voyager relaunch novels that might get moved on or changed around in sort of the TV series, or was it all quite fluid for you?
Well, I think all of that had to be let go, right? We've created this wonderful, brilliant, rich universe in this one aspect of it, and now we had to be free to start over and do whatever we wanted to, and that was easy to embrace, really. Yeah.
Finally, Jason Isaacs, best known to Trek fans as Captain Gabriel Lorca in Star Trek Discovery, was supporting the latest show by turning up for the premiere. We had a quick chat with him too.
Hello, Jason. How does it feel to be here at the premiere of Star Trek Picard?
Well, I'm warmer than you because you're shivering while I'm talking
to
you. You've been standing here longer than me. It's exciting. I'm mostly excited to see the show. The rest of this stuff is fun going in, but I've got friends who work on it, obviously, and friends who directed it, and they told me it's something very special that Patrick's doing.
How do you look back on your experience on Star Trek Discovery? You've had a few years away from it now. You still seem as passionate about it all these years on.
Stories are powerful, and the genesis and the point of the whole thing is to hold a mirror up to mankind and show us that we could do better, that we should do better. And these are increasingly dark times. We need those messages.
So been a great advocate.
I'm proud of the show, and I think it's an important show. It can regenerate forever because it's telling us to aspire.
Absolutely.
So we were all at that red carpet premiere, but I want to go back one step further before we come to them. So back in August 2018, Patrick Stewart announced his return to the franchise at Star Trek Las Vegas. Carlos, I'll start with you. What was your thoughts on the news, and what did you expect when that announcement was made?
To be perfectly honest, I was shocked. I mean, at that point, we knew that this Disco had been a big hit. It's not surprising that they went back to the greatest hits catalog and decided to pull out, one of the best songs. But the reality of it is that pulling out Patrick Stewart in a, starring in what is basically a sequel to Next Generation was, I couldn't believe it. I genuinely couldn't, I can barely believe that the show was made and that we have it now. I think that it was an unbelievable surprise. I'm extremely happy with the show, which we'll talk about in a second, I'm sure. I was flabbergasted at the time, and part of me still quite can't believe that the show was actually made and that it's now forever just like a click away on our Amazon Prime.
What about for yourself, Duncan? Obviously, none of us were out there in Las Vegas. What was it like for you, no doubt seeing the news break on Twitter and social media that Patrick Stewart was going to return to the role of Jean-Luc Picard? You've kind of touched on this quite recently in an article for StarTrek.com as well.
I was really surprised as well. I mean, there had been rumours floating around. People had been talking about this as a possibility, as something that might be coming, that there'd been talks and so on. And I kind of just dismissed all of that. I thought that was just wishful thinking. So I was astounded, to be honest, when, you know, when the news filtered through that he'd come out on that stage and had made that announcement. And then I suppose began this sort of process of anticipation, of kind of wondering what exactly the show was going to be. They said very much early on it was not going to be next gen Mark II. I mean, in fact, in the end, I feel like we've got more next gen Mark II in this show than maybe we were expecting in some ways. And then, you know, when we were in last year at Destination Star Trek, Patrick Stewart was on stage talking again a little bit about the show. That was the first inkling I had about this kind of darker side this show was going to have, because one of the fans stood up and said, would it be suitable for his six-year-old daughter to watch, who was a big fan of Next Generation? And Patrick Stewart was a bit like, I'm not sure about that, you know, maybe not in this case. And obviously that's one element of the show, I think, is that it feels like it's more, in some ways, it's more in line with Discovery and the more kind of grown-up, you know, streaming-age Star Trek than maybe the Trek that we grew up on in the 90s. But yeah, absolutely, it was, I didn't really know what to think. And I think even going into the premiere, I didn't really know what to expect or what to think, which is one reason what I talked about a little bit on that article I wrote for StarTrek.com. And, you know, we were all there watching the premiere together. It was a great night. We had an amazing time. I came out of that screening just feeling so sort of emotionally overwhelmed by it all. I couldn't really analyze it. I couldn't really even say whether it was good or not, except that it had had this big impact on me. Do you know what I mean? I kind of had to go back and watch it again, you know, a couple of weeks later or whenever it actually came out, to be able to watch it without that kind of baggage. And I think that's a big part of it for this show. And again, to be honest, with the finale, I've only watched it once. I haven't gone back and watched it a second time, though I will do, obviously. But these characters who mean so much to us, these stories that kind of tie into things that are so kind of meaningful to us going back decades, it's very hard, I think, to watch something like that without bringing all this kind of emotional baggage with you, and that kind of massively, in some ways, interfering with actually receiving what the thing is that you get. So it's interesting, you know, Carlos saying from now on, it's just a click away. You know, this is going to be on our Amazon Prime app forever, or, you know, whatever. That will change. It will change over time. But being in this period where we're getting stuff for the first time, and it's so impactful and so kind of charged in that way, it's an unusual way to watch Star Trek for anyone who's been kind of, you know, for the last, 20 years, basically relying largely on, you know, old kind of nostalgic favourites.
I always feel somewhat the same about, like, I think of that premiere as well, and I think we'll touch on that a bit more in a moment, but I always think of it when I watch a new episode of say, Star Trek Picard for the first time, you know, especially sort of that pilot episode, everything, it feels like you're sort of moving into a new home for the first time, and one that you're going to be in sort of for the rest of your life, that the theme tune isn't just going to be the theme tune of a TV show that I watch one summer and kind of dispose of. It's going to be something that if I like it or dislike it, I'm going to come back to it kind of countless times. If there's episodes I like or don't like, I'm going to watch them kind of numerous times. I'm going to talk about them, dissect them, read reviews about them. It's trying to kind of get yourself, I always trying to get myself to that vibe of, can I live with this? And is this something I'm going to kind of be happy to live with? And that's something I've always kind of felt with Star Trek, is it's sort of like it's going to be part of the kind of furniture really for the rest of my life. That's how strongly I feel about the show. And it comes with a unique pressure, I guess. Carlos, you were off to say something?
Yeah, I was going to say that I wanted to pick up on something that Duncan said, is that I remember Destination Star Trek 2 years ago, where the three of us were at. That's when we saw the what we left behind documentary, and that was that year. And Marina Sirtis took the stage, and it was shortly after Picard had been announced. And Marina seemed a little bit, I wouldn't say, I think I'd say the most diplomatic word was to say that she was disappointed. And she used the words that this was not a sequel to Next Generation, and that Patrick had told them directly that it wasn't a sequel to Next Generation, hence why they weren't in it. But it was a brand new story, right? And she seemed, you know, I think again, either irritated was one word. It was clearly before they had any inclination of having Troy and Riker back, because even Jonathan Frakes said that that insertion of that storyline in that episode came pretty late in the game. But what was interesting to me is actually that I completely disagree with that now. I genuinely think that this was very much a sequel to Next Generation. And in a way, and I just submitted an article to Trek News that should be up this week about kind of the seven things, get it? The seven things I love most or that will stick with me most about Picard's first season. And I genuinely think, and was so surprised, given how many times we were told that this was not a sequel to TNG, that actually it is a sequel to TNG. And on top of that, it's a sequel in many ways to Voyager as well, at least through the character of Seven. But I was genuinely surprised at how much, again, it was a sequel to TNG, but also it was a sequel to Voyager and some of the other kind of 24th century storylines.
I would say, though, is it the question I would ask is, I suppose it depends how you define a sequel. I mean, traditionally, if you think of like a book or a movie sequel, a movie sequel being the most obvious example, there's a tendency that the sequel tries to do the same thing as the original one, usually with a bit more money or whatever. But it's very much about recreating the experience that you had the first time round. Now, I think that this series absolutely picks up on a lot of stuff from Next Gen and from Voyager. You know, it's not its own thing. Even in some ways, I mean, I suppose Discovery isn't its own thing either, but it's even less its own thing in some ways than that. But it is picking up on a lot of that stuff. I don't know, to me, it sort of feels like it's somewhere between a sequel and, you know, kind of spin-offs that we see. If you think of, you know, something like Frasier as a spin-off of Cheers, it's a very different show, but in relation to that one character, you know, that one character carries forward, and a lot of the kind of stuff around that character kind of carries forward, but they do it in a very different format. And I do think in the case of Picard, it does have a different feel because the kind of way they're telling stories. On the other hand, there are the odd episodes where suddenly it kind of feels more Next Gen somehow, and I don't just mean when we see Riker and Troy, though obviously the Riker and Troy episode, which was my favorite of the season personally, you know, I just loved it, but also I just think there are moments where I think particularly like after those first three episodes, then you get into episode four and you're like, okay, we're going to a planet this week and we're going to kind of learn about the culture. It sort of suddenly feels a little bit more traditional Star Trek. And again with the finale, to be honest, I mean episode nine, which people were a little bit harsh on in some ways, and I think maybe it suffers a bit from being the kind of setup for part two. One of the things I quite liked about it was it really had the feel of an old Next Gen episode somehow. You know, you kind of beam down to a planet, you kind of get to know who lives there, what's going on there, what are their secrets, what's, you know, who's hiding what, what's kind of getting to grips with the community down there. It felt more kind of traditional Star Trek in some ways compared to a lot of what we've been seeing, I suppose, especially with the whole stuff with, you know, Picard on the Serena and then this other plot line on the Borg cube and this kind of the way that everything was, you know, sort of divided up and layered out and strung out over this kind of extended serialized format in a way that is, although Star Trek has done serialization before, this is a kind of different approach to serialization. I think in some ways there were these kind of moments where it felt like suddenly felt more familiar in a way, and less itself. And I wonder what you two think about that, because when we watched that first premiere episode, I mean, you know, as I say, I was overwhelmed to begin with, but I did come to really, I do love it. I think it's great. And I think those first three episodes, you know, feel very much of a piece and are basically the pilot within those three episodes. And I think I was expecting episodes 4, 5, 6, 7, etc., through to 10 to stay tonally in that kind of quite carefully delineated sort of shape or form, or you know, do you know what I mean, sort of stay within that sandbox somehow. And then actually what happened was they kept throwing in episodes that did something quite different or quite surprising, and I don't know whether it would have been better if it had been more kind of uniform, or if that is that just part of the pleasure of Star Trek, that they do kind of random off the wall things, or they do, I mean, you know, Stardust City Rag would be the obvious example in this case. With Discovery it was magic to make the sanest man go mad, you know, these episodes that kind of in some ways, they on one level, they feel more traditional Star Trek because they tap into the idea of, okay, this week we're dressing up as Romans, or, you know, we're dressing up as Nazis, or, you know, whatever it is. We're doing something kind of slightly outside the normal world of these people on their ship and their kind of lives, you know.
No, I agree. I do feel, I genuinely felt that the first three episodes were very much a set, right? Like that was, and it made sense why in the US premiere they showed them basically as like a 2-hour movie, and made sense why when the premiere in the UK, which the three of us were lucky enough to be at together, you know, Patrick Stewart kind of called out Amazon Prime for not wanting to show all three episodes together, and he very much said, you know, it's a shame that we can't show them to you, and he was clearly annoyed and wish it had been otherwise. But I agree with you. So I think I loved the first episode, and after that premiere, I was truly overwhelmed with emotion of what we had seen, because it was so familiar yet new, and it was just wonderful. And I think such a continuation, whether we call it a direct sequel or not, it was very much a continuation of the story that had ended with Nemesis and had begun with TNG. But episode 9, so the season finale part 1, was easily my least favorite episode of the 10. However, what I liked about it was that it reminded me of look and feel. And in fact, it was my wife, who's not a Trekkie, as anybody that's kind of heard me on one of these podcasts before, but she watches Star Trek with me, and she watched The Card every day, every Friday night with me. And she's become, you know, somewhat of a fan. She really liked The Card, but she really felt that episode 9 was tonally very different. And we ended up talking about it. Mm. And she commented on how light it was and how like bright it was and how it just felt differently. And I agree with you. I felt like episode 9 and to a degree episode 10, but really episode 9 felt and looked like a season 1 or season 2 episode of Next Generation. Right? I mean, you know, it kind of had that Haven look of like them down there into this planet, and they're all like this idyllic, like great bodies and like barely any clothes on. And it just felt so TOS and early TNG that it was
playing classical music and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And 3D chess, right? And like a ball game, like a random ball game in the background. I do think that I think that the tonal shift. I didn't feel it as much throughout the series as maybe you did, Dunk. But like I think at the end, I really thought it was very jarring. And we'll talk about this later on, I'm sure. But I did think that the last two were easily for me the weakest, and part of it had to do with just how tonally, just how jarring it felt from the previous 8.
I think one thing I've really taken away from it is that I find that I've really enjoyed the highlights for me of probably season 1 have been sort of some of the production aspects of it. And I've really enjoyed Michael Chabon's kind of how open he is with fans, critical he is of his own piece of work and able to reflect on it, to open himself up to all types of questions, no matter how kind of asinine or repetitive sometimes. They've been real highlights to kind of follow on Instagram and some of these interviews they've done with kind of Hollywood Reporter, where they talk about, well, you know, season 1, we're trying to, you know, I suppose the difficulty is they have 10 episodes, I think it was meant to be originally 9, where they're trying to work out these new characters, how it all works, you know, this is his first time kind of almost being the showrunner on a TV show, how does it all come together, what's the kind of, what are these characters' strengths, and you could sort of see it being a learning process for them all. And whether I'm kind of giving it a free pass or not, I always kind of give that to the first seasons of kind of a Star Trek show, to, you know, I expect them to make mistakes. Some of them can be ones that they will never come back from. I think of something like Star Trek Voyager, where by the end of the pilot, everyone's all kind of happy dory and they're on their way. But for a lot of them, it is that production element of how do you write to these people's strengths and so on. And I think as the show got on, we sort of got to see some of those kind of actors come to life. And I think we did see them sort of struggle to kind of, you know, have a consistent tone, but I think that can be somewhat expected of a really shortened run. I think they dropped the ball with maybe a few elements here and there, but I think it's going to be interesting, because I saw something the other day of like, well, now that we've got to the end of the show, I don't know what this show is and what that season 2 is going to be. I really don't know what the structure or format of season 2 is going to be, but I feel by the end of it that I want to kind of continue on a journey with these characters and see what they're like as a team. And it was the same feeling I had sort of at the end of season 1 of Discovery. Oh, I'm ready to see them kind of explore planets and kind of get down to sort of business, as you know, whether that follows through. I think season two of Discovery did that a little bit. I'm not too sure where Picard season two will go, but the structure and so on, you know, I'm curious to see what they've learned from it. And it, by all accounts, I think they have learned something from it. There's certainly no denial that they've got some issues that they've kind of ironed out over the first season, and probably now a prolonged pre-production period with all these coronavirus delays, I think could hopefully helpfully refine season two of Picard.
Well, there's definitely, I suppose, a question, isn't there? I mean, I feel like with Discovery, and we kind of have to compare this show to Discovery in some ways, as much as we have to compare it to Next Gen, because it is coming out of this sort of same era, and it does, although it seems very different, and although especially watching those first three episodes, you sort of felt they were really pointing the differences as much as possible, in many ways it shares some of the elements of Discovery, I suppose, that people maybe have slight qualms about, I think. And for me, I mean, I would say, I think Michael Chabon is the best thing that's happened to Star Trek for decades. You know, I think he's a fantastic writer. I mean, it sort of goes without saying, but I loved his short Calypso. I thought that was one of the best Star Trek episodes I'd seen for a long time when that came out. And I love a lot of the stuff that he's done with this series as well. And, you know, you can kind of see with the finale, with the stuff with Data, you can see that's the same guy who wrote Calypso. Do you know what I mean? It's got that kind of, it's very sort of intelligent. It's very kind of, but also very emotional, but kind of, I don't know, it's sort of pushing Star Trek in a slightly less cozy, less comfortable direction, but still leaning on the kind of nostalgia and leaning on the kind of familiar. I do wonder slightly, we've heard Patrick Stewart talking endlessly about how great it was to be in that writer's room and how they'd have these amazing ideas and then throw them out and nothing, you know, everything was permissible and, you know, there were no bad ideas and it was all this kind of brilliant creative experience. And obviously we saw in the DS9 documentary, you know, as you mentioned, Carlos, you know, we saw a sort of glimpse into the DS9 writer's room, which I would say of all the Star Trek series is the best written. And obviously there were clunkers of episode in DS9 as well. I do find it strange with this show, Picard. They only have 10 episodes. It's even shorter than a season of Discovery. They kept saying this thing about how it's like a novel. It's, you know, it's structured like a novel. You can't expect it to be like old Star Trek, which is kind of episodic and can do different things, different weeks. And where there the kind of variety is part of the pleasure. This is supposed to be one story. It's one story told out over 10 episodes. I do find it strange because watching it, I don't really feel that what we got was a novel. I mean, I've never written a novel, but I write a lot of narrative non-fiction books. When you're planning a book like that, you're thinking, you know, you've got the kind of overall shape of it. You're also thinking, how do all the elements fit into that shape and how do they sort of feed into it somehow, and what role do they play? And I do sort of wonder whether with this series, as much as I loved it, you know, I loved it overall. I thought it was a great experience and amazing to see Patrick Stewart back and so on. But the one thing I wasn't 100% sure on is, I suppose I did think going into it, we were going to get something that felt a little bit more like a novel, that felt a little bit more like one story told kind of in a more consistent way. I was surprised that we didn't end up back at the Vineyard at the end. I sort of assumed, you know, when we said goodbye to Laris and Shaban and the dog in episode 3, you know, which was kind of a sad moment, I kind of thought, well, at least we're going to, you know, we're going to catch up with them at the end, because somehow this story is going to come full circle. It's going to kind of have that shape to it. Whereas in fact, what it did was it sort of went, it took a while to get going. It sort of went off and then it went off and off and off. And now it's gone in, like, as you say, completely new direction. Who knows what kind of show season two is going to be? And Discovery is kind of doing the same thing, you know, going into the future. Season three of Discovery, again, who knows, you know, what are the ground rules? What are the stakes? What's the kind of, what kind of show is this? And I feel like that's quite, maybe that's quite unfamiliar with Star Trek. I mean, we've seen, say, in Deep Space Nine, bringing in the Dominion and the Dominion War. Obviously, that shifted the kind of, what that show was about to some extent. With Enterprise, I guess you had the same thing, you know, with the Zindi War, that kind of totally turned that show on its head. But I don't know, generally with Star Trek, there's a bit more of a kind of sense, you sort of laid the groundwork from the beginning of what the show is. And I think by the end of those first three episodes, we had a very strong sense of what we thought Star Trek Picard was. And now with the end of the season and going into season two, I'm sort of wondering, is that true? Do we know what the show is anymore? I mean, you know, I'm going to be watching it, it's going to be brilliant, whatever it is. But it does it have an identity in that way that in some ways I would say Discovery never quite, maybe quite found its identity. And I'm hoping it will do with this jump into the future, you know. What's it going to be like? And then what's season three going to be? Are they just going to throw out the rule book again for season three and do something again kind of completely different? I don't know. I guess maybe that's where TV is going these days. And maybe I'm a kind of, old-fashioned TV viewer with my expectations. But I do find it strange. It doesn't feel like the novel that we were promised is what I would say.
It's interesting. I thought if I was a betting man, I would have bet all the money in the world that it was going to end on the Vineyard as well. And I remember, I don't know who I was, it might have been you, Duncan, who I spoke to this, I was speaking about this to someone. I really felt that Chabon, and who I think is a wonderful writer, and who I think I'm so, you know, the scenes with Data in the finale, and I found the finale very problematic on a lot of different, structurally, there's a lot of things that I did not care for in the finale. It's the only two episodes I felt very strongly about were in a critical way were those last two, I thought the scenes with Data were phenomenal. And to your point, it is very apparent that the same person that wrote Calypso wrote those scenes. But what was interesting is I thought that this entire series, not just the season, was about a man. I think the identity of the show to me was about a man in the twilight of his life dealing with his own mortality. That's really legitimately what I thought the show was about, right? And at the very end, you take that away from him. Now, from a narrative perspective, you could say he's been carrying this baggage since the last episode of TNG. We dealt with it for 10 hours, right? In one cohesive story, whether we succeeded or not is neither here nor there. But I can understand their thought process of saying, the first season was about him dealing with his mortality, and the second season is going to be him dealing with like a rebirth. I kind of get that, but it's not necessarily, it's not that I didn't want that. It's just, that's not what I was expecting at all. I genuinely thought, I wasn't thinking about it from the novel, from the structure of a novel, but I genuinely thought that the last bit of this season would end up right at the beginning, right? And he would have kind of gone through something. And again, if I was a betting man, I thought that he was going to end up on his vineyard again. But the difference is that Soji would be there with him. And the next season, a key component of that season is, here's his dying man. Now, all of a sudden, with a new challenge of kind of raising this new Data, right? And there would have been almost like a new cast of characters in a new story. I'm very surprised, extremely surprised, that characters like Jurati and even Seven and Rafi, which, by the way, I loved Rafi, and Rios to me, which I'm sure we'll talk about, is an absolute revelation for a variety of reasons. But I'm very surprised that this cast of characters is all coming back for the next season. Like, it just doesn't, like, it just seems like now we're ending and it's a crew on a mission, which was what we were told over and over and over again. This wasn't what this was about.
Because in Voyager, it made sense that happened because they were stuck there. Do you know what I mean? There was no, these two crews were stuck together. They were going to have to get on. Those are your characters for the show. Every other show, they've been assigned to that job. That's why they have to be there. This kind of ragtag group where Rios is in some slightly ill-defined way being paid by Picard to go along with it all. It does sort of make me wonder, you know, what is going to happen? Unless it's just that, like, you know, a bit like with Discovery in episode, you know, 2 minutes into episode one of season two, some kind of crisis intervenes and they have to deal with that straight away. And do you know what I mean? They're not assuming that they're all together for the duration and they're on their way home. And then something happens and they have to deal with it. But again, if they kind of keep pulling that trick, they're, you know, going to get three seasons out of it, then it starts to feel a bit, it starts to feel slightly improbable in that sense.
Pulling on a kind of thread Carlos mentioned about sort of this overall arc of the season, for me, what blew my mind and has made me completely reconsider some of the positives and frustrations I had with Next Generation, but with a focus more on the movies, is that I kind of view sort of season one as, and I think Broken Pieces really nailed it, is that it's a love story between Picard and Data. And I was really affected by kind of that, of this idea that you have these two kind of men that struggle to articulate their emotions and feelings, that fall in love with each other, that Picard is kind of, you know, as a character and a captain, is often drawn to sort of Data's journey and supporting him. And then in the movies, they are so well connected. You know, you have Picard, you know, trying to help Data through his emotion chip, you know, going back to kind of almost certain doom to try and help his friend in First Contact, you know, risking his life in Insurrection, Nemesis, you know, Data sacrifices himself for that. Like, you have Picard grieving for decades, going on this mission, you know, certain doom and death, to kind of find a little spark of his friend. And that scene where he tells Soji how much he loved him in his own way, and just that final scenes together, was like, that's maybe what Next Generation and kind of these movies have retroactively been sort of changed in my mind to be, is this huge sprawling love arc, you know, in a very asexual show that the Next Generation and Star Trek often is. It had one of the best love stories of all time, and I can scarcely think of a better kind of ending for a love story than the one we got. And I think what Picard absolutely nailed in that first season, by and large, was the sort of the drama with Patrick Stewart and how he interacted with people, you know, Riker, Troy, Soji, his new kind of crew, Seven, all these sorts of things. There was so much well-written kind of drama, and then the action could often be forgettable or badly plotted and maybe not kind of fell into place, whereas it was often the other way around with Discovery, that had great action scenes, great to look at, and somewhat the kind of characters and drama wasn't often the most engaging or kind of follow through. Whereas I think Picard nailed that, and I would love to see sort of a kind of balance between the two kind of going forward in Star Trek as a whole.
I think the love story, I mentioned something on Twitter, and I think both of you engaged with it, about what was interesting. One of the things that, you know, to your point, Lee, this show, and this is an absolute triumph of the writers and of the actors, I think. This is something that I never thought would be possible, because to Dunk's point earlier, we've been living with TNG for 30 years, right? Like, this is, TNG ended in May of 1994, right? Nemesis came out in December 2002. What's amazing is that at the end of this season, let's say that for whatever reason, the show never comes back, right? And I don't want that at all, by the way. I'm dying for season two. This show has forever, and the ending of that relationship and that story and that arc has forever changed the way I look at Nemesis. It's made Nemesis better, for the record, right? And I think it's made me look at their entire relationship, which I think has always been a little bit fatherly, a little bit paternal from the point of view of Patrick Stewart. I think their relationship and their love is more akin to a father and a son, or like a mentor and a mentee, than anything else. And I think it will forever, it has forever changed the way I look at that. And I can think of so many episodes of TNG where it's just Picard and Data talking about, you know, Picard's, Data's latest acting, it will forever change that. And I think that's one of the biggest triumphs of the show. It's just, for me, the fact that something that has been, that the three of us have lived with for so long, for most of our lives, has been, we can retroactively change it for the better, right? I think of like the Star Wars prequels and how, or not the Star Wars prequels, like the Star Wars prequels and sequels, and how, to me, they didn't impact my love, in fact, of the original trilogy. I think what the prequel trilogy and the sequel trilogy made me even more walled off for the original trilogy. And like, I've now like hold the original trilogy as this thing that's been trying to be changed by something that was supposed to come before and something that comes after. And for me, none of those things succeeded at all. However, with Picard, they succeeded in a way that I look back fondly on Next Generation and a movie like Nemesis. And really, like, now that I know how their, now that we all know how their story ends, it's just made it better.
It's one of those things that the new Star Treks occasionally, I think, can do really well. I mean, my favourite Discovery episode was Lethe, because of the way that episode did what you could call fan service in a way, in that it tied into a kind of big pre-existing storyline and question, this kind of issue of what had gone wrong between Spock and Sarek, but did it in such a brilliant way and kind of turned it on its head and kind of gave you, didn't just give you kind of the obvious, gave you something really quite surprising and quite shocking, but that totally fit emotionally, structurally, with everything that we knew already. And I think that is quite hard to do. And I think, Carlos, you're right that this show makes Nemesis work better than Nemesis works on its own somehow. I mean, it's a better end for Data. It's not really what I was expecting from this show at all. I mean, I sort of thought either Data is just around as a kind of echo or a dream or something, which is kind of what I figured from the beginning. Or occasionally I'd sort of harboured this idea, is Data going to come back by the end of this season? Is that what this is all sort of leading towards? They're going to find a way of bringing him back properly, maybe in a new body or a new form or in a hologram, or I don't know, who knows what. And weirdly, they could have done that. I mean, they found Data at the end. You know, he was there. His consciousness, his kind of identity was there. They could have, I don't know if they could have put him in the golem, but they there was almost that possibility. And there's that weird sense that, again, there's this sort of, there's always this sort of switch between Picard and Data, this kind of yin and yang thing going on almost, with which of them, I think part of what was awkward about Nemesis was really you sort of thought Picard should have sacrificed himself to save Data on some level, or I did anyway. I mean, you know, Picard is saying that in this show. He's carried around all this guilt and he sort of feels like he should have been the one to do that. It shouldn't necessarily have been Data doing that. There's also this weird sense in this series, it felt certainly from those first few episodes and pretty much the whole way through, that what this series was all about was, as you say, Picard's mortality. Look, I wrote a whole feature for StarTrek.com about that, which they dropped the day before this final episode, which basically slightly shot out of the water everything I've been saying, because I assumed that was the theme of the show. It was about Picard facing up to his mortality. I mean, one of the most moving moments in the whole show, and again, I think an indication of how brilliant Michael Chabon's writing is Deanna Troi's reaction when she meets him and she says, "How are you?" And he says, "I'm fine." And she obviously understands he's lying and she embraces him. And that kind of sense of just, you know, just in a moment like that, that sense of this man grappling with his mortality and how to kind of, how much to share with other people and what to say. And we see that again when he kind of tells his crew what's going on, and he says, and he actually swears for once, and, you know, says, "I'm going to be pissed off if you treat me any differently." But then what we get, of course, is not only do they take the mortality issue away from Picard, but the show does end with a character dying, and it's Data dying. And that's the most extraordinary thing, because we thought Data died 20 years ago. And now we find out that this show was about Data's death, not about Picard's death in some ways. So there's this weird sense, I suppose, of this bond between them. I mean, not just the kind of emotional bond, which I think is right to point out. And I love the way the show allows Picard to talk about those things and basically expresses what is kind of subtext from TNG, maybe, or that the audience recognizes on some level, or maybe also that what we feel as the audience, you know, that we love both these characters, we love their relationship, there's, you know, we have a lot of love for Data as well.
I think on that episode, the episode with Troi and Riker is hands down, I think, the best episode of the series, right? My second favorite is Stardust City Rag, which we can talk about later. I think what worked so well about that episode is that, one, as an aside, Marina Sirtis has never been better, and Troi has never been my favorite character, in large part because I thought, you know, like, Marina's acting was not up unto par and to other people on that show. And the writing, I also feel like she always got the short end of the stick with the writing. But Marina was amazing. Like, she was incredible. And I think that moment, and if I close my eyes, I can see it, the way she looks at Picard, and not just, she didn't need to be an empath to know that he was lying, right? And I think that was such a beautiful moment, and it highlights, and I talk about this in this article that I just wrote, that the show, when it worked best, and I argue, and I think as well with Stardust City Rag, is that when it took a piece of nostalgia, but it wasn't necessarily for fan services purposes. We find Seven, we find Picard, we find Data, we find Riker, we find Troy. All the legacy characters that we are shown in this show are in a completely different place than anyone thought they were. In a completely different place. Yet, what's amazing is that it's completely believable. Completely believable, and a nice progression and a natural evolution of their original stories. I buy the Seven of Nine as Robin Hood thing completely, like from the beginning. Like immediately, I was like, this makes perfect sense for Seven. And not to go off on a Seven tangent, because I think the show did, I love the way the show used her. But I think with Riker and Troy, you know, we find them in this kind of like just... They like Picard at one point were broken, right? Picard is a broken person. The show, I think another theme of the show, or at least his first season, is about, and you can even see it in the imagery of the opening credits. This is about broken people. Everybody on the show is broken in some way, and what they're trying to do is piece themselves back together. And I think that with Riker and Troy, they were broken, but they fix themselves slowly but surely. And that episode, and again, why I think the show worked so well overall, and when the show worked the best, was when it took nostalgia, but it wasn't fan service. It gave us something different and surprising, but never forgot where the show was coming from. And I think that's what ultimately why I think the show was a triumph, despite not thinking that every episode was a home run.
I'll pose this one to you first, Duncan. What were some of your sort of highlights or moments or casting or anything that you came away with going, I was really impressed with that, that kind of made Star Trek Picard a show for you that's kind of stood out?
I think there are so many. I mean, Patrick Stewart, we knew was going to be great, but he was great in new ways as well as familiar ways, which I think was nice. And both the writing and the performance, I think, allowed Picard to show new sides of his character. And we saw that even right from the beginning. I mean, I think we talked about after the premiere, the scene with Darge, where he has this real kind of grandfatherly quality to him, which I sort of didn't really expect. I sort of expected we'd get a kind of older, sort of, if anything, sort of sterner Picard somehow, whereas actually we get a kind of more, he has his kind of grumpy moments, but a sort of more emotionally available one in some ways. And I think that was great. I mean, I loved pretty much all of the new cast. I also liked very much Seven of Nine. I found Seven of Nine more interesting in this show than I did in Voyager ever, to be perfectly honest. And I liked her better as a character. And that's not to say that I hated her in Voyager or anything, but I really enjoyed who she was here. It was nice seeing Hugh again. But a lot of the new characters as well. I mean, I loved Alison Pill. From the start, I loved all of them, to be honest, but Rios absolutely was a real revelation. I mean, just an amazing, I mean, all those holograms and the amazing differentiation in the performances. I liked Raffi as well. I mean, I think they were great. I think they were a great cast of characters. And even Elnor, to be honest, I've seen some people kind of giving the guy who plays Elnor a bit of stick. I mean, I think you can tell he's the least experienced of that group of very talented and very experienced performers, but I thought he was fine. I thought he was quite a sweet character. You know, I'm very happy to see more of where he goes, you know, sort of going forward. And also, I just think there were moments that kind of, there are the sort of moments that jump out. I mean, the shots of that Borg cube crashed in the water. Really beautiful, beautiful imagery. The orchids. Some people hate the orchids. I love the orchids. I thought, wow, that's, you know, crazy. This is kind of, you know, I quite like it when the show does something off the wall. And obviously, finally, that whole final sequence with Picard and Data, which was not really what I was expecting in terms of where this show was going to go or where the show was going to end at all. You know, really, really good writing, really kind of beautiful moments. And unexpectedly, like Carlos said, you know, the moments that could have just been pure fan service and actually were so much more. I mean, Nepenthe being the obvious example. I personally think, you know, in episode 10, the way that Riker was used was a slightly lazy bit of fan service. but he kind of got away with it. But generally speaking, but that was sort of the exception. Do you know what I mean? And the fact is, Nepenthe could have been 45 minutes of that, and it would have been all right. And, you know, it would have been nice to see them all together and so on. But what we got was something so much deeper. And I do think that the quality of the writing, it, you know, on the level of every individual script was so good, because they would take something like that and they would really go into it and really, you know, make that a story with the requisite depth and meaning and kind of weight, and absolutely nailed it.
What about for yourself, Carlos? You touched on one or two a bit earlier on. What were the highlights, the special moments, the parts that kind of really sung to you as a fan?
I think a few, and it's funny because, again, I just wrote this piece, and so, which was all about my seven favorite things, so I have them in my head. One, I think, was the emotional, Picard's emotional arc, right? This, you have a man here that knows he's dying, broken, trying to put the pieces, again, back together. And what he learns throughout this adventure is that it's the people that he loved, right, that ultimately that's what matters. Data, Riker, Troy. And if you follow Picard, you know, Picard was always this, like, very stoic, very kind of, you know, I don't hang out with the crew. I'm their leader. They have to look up to me. There needs to be a divorce and there should be some sort of separation. Yes, they'll do things together. And he hung out with Data and Beverly. But, like, the reality of it is that he always kept himself at arm's length. Hence why that moment in All Good Things when he enters the poker game is so, it has carries such weight, right? Because here he is finally opening up with his crew. One of my favorite things is his arc, right? To see Picard openly, yes, in his own way, but openly talk about his love for Data. You know, the scene when he, and right before he's about to beam out in Nepenthe, and he hugs, and if you watch closely, he kisses both Riker and Troy. Right, this is a man that's gone through this journey, and he was so closed off, and by the end of it learns that actually that affection, that love that he has for people that care for him, that love him back, is really what's worth, you know, what living is all about and what it should be about. And I just thought that kind of his emotional arc was phenomenal. Rios to me is a revelation on so many levels. You know, I'm, you know, my family is is Spanish and Latin American, and in Star Trek, even though you had characters that were Spanish or Latin American descent and you've kind of had them forever, it was never part of their personhood. It was always like a surname, right? It them being, you know, them being like Latin or them being Spanish had nothing to do with their character other than their surname and maybe the way they looked. And here you are, you have this character that is, you know, in the show, he's supposed to be Chilean, and he's played by a Venezuelan-born Chilean actor. I loved the fact, yes, I loved the holograms, and I thought, you know, it was really, yeah, I thought they were really cute, and that scene where Rafi's talking to all of them is phenomenal, and I loved that. But I think it's the first time in Star Trek, even though Star Trek does representation so well, they do representation so, so well, they don't necessarily always play to, like, the cultural differences between humans very well. Yeah, sure, there are some instances and things like that, but we're just humans, right? And I think in Picard, you have this character that is very much human, yet he's of a different culture than Picard, right? And he embraces that, and I absolutely love that. And the fact that he spoke Spanish all the time, particularly when he was cursing, like, it was just wonderful. So to me personally, there was this, like, oh wow, like, you know, there's someone kind of like me who speaks both languages, and, like, so it was wonderful to see that. And last but not least, Laris and oh my god, now I can't forget his name. Laris and Siobhan were also a revelation. What was amazing to me is that those two characters, I wanted to spend all the time with those characters. And it wasn't just, like, Orla Brady's amazing, like, Irish Romulan twang. It was, like, these are two new characters that were only in parts of three episodes, yet they felt as lived into Star Trek as Patrick Stewart, which is amazing to me, right? And they were so interesting. I, like, I wanted to spend all my time with them. Who were they? How were these two Tal Shiars related to Picard? Like, why were they there? Like it was, why were they protecting Picard? Like, there was, that is so rich for mining. And so to me, three things that stick out: Picard's emotional arc, which I thought was lovely and wonderful and beautiful. Rios, who was a great character, but also spoke to me very personally. I'm sure he appealed to your Spanish heritage, right, Duncan? And I think Laris and Saban were just, I mean, the fact that they went toe to toe with Patrick Stewart, but felt just as lived in, was to me amazing.
My girlfriend was desperate for them to return as well.
Oh, like, totally.
She's been watching the show with me, and I always use her as my, like, I think this is a huge fan. I know what the internet thinks of things, both positive and negative. And I like to hear her thoughts of, like, yeah, that was a little bit silly or that. And she was like, oh, I want to see the people that are on the vineyard again and stuff. And I was like, no, I don't think they're coming. Or things that people go, oh, you clearly need to be a fan to know this. Or it's so kind of, you know, a wink and a nod to that. Like, you know, oh, this, I think I saw something where it's like, oh, this brain thing that Picard has, you clearly need to have seen All Good Things to get it. And whereas, like, I was reminding my girlfriend as we were kind of getting to the final episode, she doesn't always pay attention. Sometimes she's playing with her phone when these things. I was like, oh yeah, and just remind, but Picard has this syndrome. Oh yeah, he's got, like, a brain condition or something like that. He's dying. Yeah, okay, yeah, clearly. But, like, those characters seem to have been the real breakouts. And for me, I also loved Rios. I mean, he was one of the characters I had a lot of worries about going into the show, solely based on sort of what I saw. Was like, oh no, we're going to get sort of a, you know, a Han Solo type, you know, cigar chomping kind of character. I was like, we've kind of seen that done before, you know, don't go down that road. And that was put to one side so quickly. I think what I liked the most really was, you know, in addition to everything that you guys have said, is that it feels like two decades have kind of passed. You know, I think we're all fans of Star Wars to some extent here, but I feel with the sequel trilogy there, I always kind of felt with characters that, and the show itself, that life kind of, you know, the Empire falls, and then you kind of watch this like 20, 30 years later, oh, it's stormtroopers and the same kind of ships and iconography, and, you know, this kind of Han Solo's kind of doing what he's doing, and Leia's leading a rebellion, and Luke's kind of, you know, a bit different. Yeah, okay. And it kind of was like, all right, everything's still much such in the right place. Whereas this, it felt like time had passed. These were kind of damaged kind of characters that we left in good places. You know, dreams didn't often all come together. I really loved that kind of lived in feel. And I felt that they'd learned a lot from kind of the mistakes that the Star Wars sequel trilogy made, whether you're a fan or not. There's some inherent flaws in there, I think. But it was also things like with Soji. She was one of these big characters. Everyone was debating, like, who is Soji? You know, there's so much mystery. And it was the same in the interview. She was like, people are debating about this character. Some people are right, some people are wrong. I guess you'll have to tune into the show to find out her origin. And I loved how that was pretty much 90% addressed by the end of the first episode. So you weren't kind of feeling it's some sort of huge mystery box where it's like, oh, it's kind of going to be like Rey. Is she this person? Is she that person? And did she come from that? Is she Data's daughter? Is that? It's like, yeah, she's kind of been devised from Data's and Euron. You kind of go, okay, sure. I'm sure there'll be more to learn as we go. But it's not going to be sort of some big mystery box kind of character that we're going to be kind of potentially disappointed with in the end. So I really, really did enjoy that. I think we've spoke a lot about the positive side, but for yourself, Carlos, what were maybe some of the missed opportunities, some of the criticisms you might have for kind of that first season? What maybe didn't kind of work well for you?
Yeah, I have a couple. I mean, I think it's funny that you say, because my wife, as again, has watched hundreds of hours of Star Trek and knows a lot more through osmosis. And she's come to really love, like, Deep Space Nine and elements of Voyager and things like that. Funny, because she hasn't watched a lot of Next Generation, and the Data scenes that the three of us have, like, waxed lyrically about and I think are beautiful and amazing, to her didn't hit home at all. To her, they were like, what? Like, Data hasn't been back since the first season. What does this mean? And it was really interesting because I watched it, to Duncan's point, I watched it with 30 years worth of baggage, right? And so, to me, I had this was like a 30-year payoff, which was incredible. But to her, someone that had no connection, and Next Generation, even though I absolutely adore Next Generation, It's probably the one that she has watched like the least of. And to her, those scenes didn't make a lot of sense. They were like, "What? Why is he back?" Like he, like it just didn't carry the same. Like it didn't resonate with her in the same way that it resonated with me. And so I'm interested to think to see what people who, you know, who just watched it casually, it didn't carry that emotional baggage, what they thought of the Data elements in the last episode, which I just want to throw out there because I think it's interesting. I really felt that the last two episodes just didn't work. I like completely just didn't, like, I would give every episode, episodes 1 through 8, anything from an A plus in Nepenthe, Stardust, City Rag, things like that. And I wouldn't have given anything else a B plus to A plus for sure. I really felt that the last two episodes, too many things that have been building up, too many mysteries, too many story threads were just like immediately done away with. Like, you know, all of a sudden they did away with the band. What are you talking about? This entire thing, the part of this, a key component of the story is that this like ban on synthetics, and at the end it's just like a throwaway line of like, oh, they've done away with the ban. I'm sorry, wait, how long was Picard like asleep or like in the Gollum thing? So I think that they did drop the ball a little bit with key story elements. I thought the another example, you know, you have Commodore O, which I thought was a phenomenal villain. Like, how do you have this Tal Shiar, you know, rise through the ranks to become the head of Starfleet security? How cool is that? And what a great story. And then you have Riker show up and be like, Commodore General, whatever the hell you're calling yourself these days, get out of here. And she just kind of leaves. Like, what? Like, so I felt that they wrap things up. Too many interesting points were wrapped up too quickly. Right, you know, her name is, I'm forgetting her name, the evil Dodge gold one, you know, Sutra, exactly. You know, like Sutra is like kind of built up, is being built up for an episode and a half to be this, and to be this, like the puppet master behind all of this, and literally soon just turns her off, and that's it. So I felt that the ending, even though, you know, I liked it. Again, the scenes with Data were lovely. I thought that they were components of it that I thought were wonderful. You know, the Borg cube in the water was an amazing effect shot. I also liked I think the orchids harkened back to like weird TOS sci-fi, you know, like Space Lincoln-esque. So I really appreciated it. I thought there were some great moments, some great effects. But it didn't come together. Those two episodes did not come together the way the previous 8 had come together, so I think my biggest regrets, or I guess I can't really call it regrets, the things I liked least were kind of how quickly certain key storylines that you had been following for weeks and weeks just kind of were resolved. I thought there was some lazy writing in the last one, which it seemed to me like it was rushed. It seems like the special effects were very much rushed at the end. We know it's now kind of accepted and reported that they delivered the special effects, and I'm sure it has to do with coronavirus, were delivered like a day or two before it went live on Amazon and on CBS All Access, which would explain, like, I think why the fleet is just one ship replicated over and over again. But I think that didn't really bother me, but I think it's kind of symbolic of what's wrong with the season finale, is that it felt, with some very key exceptions, it felt lazy and like they wrapped up things too quickly. What happened to Narek? Why are Jurati now, like, why are they a couple with Rios? Like, wasn't she supposed to, weren't they going to take her to Deep Space 12 to be, you know, she killed Maddox in like in cold blood, horribly. You know, so I just think that like they had been building up, and the Gollum thing, I'm of two minds about it. On the one hand, I can tell myself why I like it. You know, I think it's a very Star Trek story of Picard dying but coming back as a minority, a persecuted minority, and he has to stand up for them. But yet, with the synth ban already lifted, it kind of took away from some of that potential. So anyway, I just thought that that it didn't end on the high that it started or continued from, you know, till episode 9.
I was just going to say, just to pick up on what Carlos was saying there, I suppose the ban could be lifted, but that doesn't mean that the prejudice goes away necessarily. And I suppose one of the things that I quite liked that we saw in the show was this kind of almost sort of lawless world. I mean, the controversial scene with Icheb, whatever you think about the level of gore and so on, it certainly hammered home this idea that the Borg are being kind of used and abused and kind of, and that is because they have the, I mean, you know, on one level, I suppose that happened to Seven of Nine in Voyager in some ways, people were after nanoprobes or whatever, but you got this sort of sense of them as this kind of, and the XBs as this kind of, they're almost another set of refugees. You know, you've got the Romulans as these refugees who no one can quite decide whether they can be bothered to help them or not. Now you've got this other set of refugees who are kind of despised because of their Borg past or whatever. And there's a link there, obviously, with the synthetics, you know, the ones that kind of aren't quite human. So I suppose you could say in season two, just because that ban has been overturned, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be plain sailing for the synthetics. And if we do see Robert Picardo, for example, in season two, which I know they were talking about, that might be an interesting take on some of the same issues one way or another, given where his sort of storylines were going at the very tail end of Voyager. I mean, for me, the kind of reservations that I have, I do think the ending was strange. I mean, I suppose the thing is, it depends. Obviously, they always knew where they were going with these 10 episodes. If you think the climax of the storyline is Picard dying and being reborn and Picard's relationship with Data, then in a way it works fine. But if you were expecting the climax of the storyline to be unleashing this synth catastrophe sort of doomsday scenario, these two massive fleets meeting and battling it out, you know, I feel like a lot of things were set up as I was kind of expecting, and I don't know if this is a bad thing, because I feel like Discovery tends to sort of set up these huge final episodes and then there's just like action galore. And in some ways, the story can almost get lost in that level of action. But I do think in this example, it was all leading towards something that never happened. I mean, basically, they opened that portal, we saw those things for like half a second, and then it got closed again. All these ships finally arrived that we've been waiting to see, and yes, they were a kind of copy and paste job. And then there wasn't a fight. And in some ways, you could say that's very TNG. That is exactly what always happens with the Romulans in TNG, is they turn up and they kind of face off and have a little kind of poker moment. And then they all go home and, you know, sort of skulk off and everything's fine. But I do sort of wonder whether dramatically, if you've literally been leading up to that for 10 episodes, it feels a little bit of a kind of anticlimax in some ways.
I posed a question the other day where I kind of was sitting there reflecting on my second viewing of, like, I see a lot of parallels between this, the finale in terms of the action and expectation, and something like Deep Space Nine's Sacrifice of Angels, where you have this whole build-up of will this ragtag team stop a portal opening up which is going to bring doom to the galaxy and so on, and, you know, the captain goes out there and, you know, Picard obviously sacrifices his life in it. Sisko makes a deal that will eventually kind of almost take his life away from him in an extent, and that you have this ship facing off against an armada, and then due to the intervention of a captain making a heroic speech, the action scene that you're all expecting to take place with this huge fleet of enemy vessels doesn't happen, and you get the Star Trek ending of words kind of save the day. And I kind of like that, because as you say with Next Generation, here comes the battle, the Romulans are going to kind of scamper off and so on, and I thought that was really good, because with Discovery, yeah, they do the action spectacles and it's interesting enough, but gone are the days where in Star Trek it was rare to see an action sequence and you would want to see more of them. You know, we get our fill of them now. I love to see the kind of, you know, the speeches being made, you know, the grandstanding, that sort of stuff, and then going, yep, we didn't have to see that action sequence. I was happy enough that it was just flowers being kind of shot up.
I mean, I'm not normally one who thinks Star Trek should be full of like whiz-bang action sequences. I suppose I would say, though, that with Sacrifice of Angels, you've had other stuff before that point. Do you know what I mean? This is, like you said, this is the last chance, desperate, last moment. It's not like nothing has paid off sort of in the more expected way up to that point. You know, you've had the kind of battles and so on. In this case, I don't know. I did just feel it was a slightly weird. It just felt slightly weird that so much had been leading towards this moment when this moment wasn't really going to happen on some level. But I don't know. I feel like that episode sort of redeemed itself with all the stuff that happened. The kind of coda essentially was the thing that made the episode. And I did sort of wonder on one level, and this is kind of speculation, but just having watched Discovery as well and watching this and having seen Calypso and, you know, having seen interviews with Michael Chabon and so on, I couldn't help thinking, are there kind of two storytelling impulses here? One, the sort of Kurtzman impulse, and one, the Chabon impulse. And, you know, I mean, I might be wrong, but I would guess, if, you know, if I had to put money on it, I would say it's Chabon who wanted the story to lead towards Picard and Data and that beautiful scene that he wrote. And someone is saying, we need this kind of, you know, this kind of universe destroying apocalyptic scenario in there as well. You know, we need these kind of huge plot elements, which I think Star Trek doesn't always need to have. And in some ways, I don't know, I don't know that the whole kind of synth apocalypse thing was necessarily particularly helpful to the what was interesting about the story for the season, as much as it was a kind of driving, a sort of narrative drive for it. I mean, in terms of other things that I wasn't wild about, it's difficult because I tell you what I feel. I deliberately didn't rewatch many of these episodes many times because I wanted to watch it all through sort of in first run and then go back and watch the whole thing. And I haven't, you know, and I will go back and watch it probably in the next couple of weeks. And I'm kind of curious to see how it plays on a second viewing without all the kind of baggage and all the expectations and so on. I've seen a lot of people complaining that they felt this season didn't stand on its own, that you needed to, I mean, you know, Carlos, you were saying, what's the story with Laris and Chabon? Well, having read one of the comics that came out, I could kind of, you know, give you an approximate answer to that question. You know, we've all read Una McCormack's brilliant novel, which sort of fills in a lot of the detail about the Romulan mission. I personally feel that the show sort of worked on its own from a plot point of view, although those ancillary materials do fill in a lot extra. But there maybe is a more serious criticism if people who aren't familiar with Next Gen are coming to it and being like, okay, so what's the deal with Data? Why should I care? Or kind of, it's not, in a sense, the way that Discovery is a kind of gateway drug to Star Trek and they kind of sell it as that. I don't think this show is. On the other hand, I don't really know if that's a problem. And personally, I just don't care because I feel like this is the show that I, on a more fundamental level, this is the show I want to see. And I am one of those nostalgic fans who fell in love with Next Gen, you know, 20 or 30 years ago. So it's hard for me to really see that as a criticism, but I can see that as potentially an issue. Just a much smaller thing, on a much smaller level, what I sort of felt with the show is that, aside from these kind of big things, there were moments here and there where I felt that it slightly dropped the ball, or where the kind of careful, precise way that it had been structured and so on kind of slightly faltered. I mean, to give one example, O's sunglasses was the kind of moment I think a lot of people were just like, what's going on there? But for me, actually, funnily enough, the thing that bothered me, I don't know if it bothered me the most in the season, but one thing that really bothered me, Carlos, you said Stardust City Rag was your favourite episode. That was my least favourite episode by miles. Now, again, okay, right. Sorry, second favourite. Now, again, I haven't gone back and rewatched it, and I will go back and watch it kind of knowing what to expect. I was completely bamboozled by it. And one of the things, and this is a very small thing, that I didn't like about it was Patrick Stewart's ridiculous French accent. And the reason I didn't like that is twofold. One, because I don't think that Picard would do that accent. And two, because I've seen Patrick Stewart doing that accent a dozen times on different chat shows, on different, at Destination Star Trek. It's like a comedy routine he's developed in the last couple of years that he does. And normally what he does is he does the Space, the Final Frontier in this terrible French accent. And he says that they considered whether Picard should have a French accent. And I just sort of thought in that episode that was so obviously something he probably said to Jonathan Frakes, you know, how about I use this stupid accent that I've been doing? And they were like, yeah, that's a great idea. You know, they're kind of having fun with it. And to me, it just spoiled it because I thought I was watching Patrick Stewart in that episode and not Picard. And I know that Patrick Stewart has talked a lot about how he and Picard have kind of become merged to some extent. I mean, he was talking about this even when we went to the premiere. I was lucky enough to go along to the press roundtables the next day and speak to various of the actors, and including him. And he was saying that then, that, you know, he felt that he and Picard had kind of come closer together than they ever were before. But at some moments, I think it's important to recognise that there are distinctions between Patrick Stewart, who is quite a cheeky, playful, fun kind of guy, and Picard, who, as much as he may have mellowed and as much as he, you know, might have been willing to play the poker game and so on, I don't think really is that guy. And again, actually, to be honest, and I feel sort of mean-spirited saying this, but Carlos, when you say he was kissing Jonathan Frakes, he was, well, sorry, that's exactly my point, he was kissing Riker, I don't believe that Picard, however much he's mellowed and warm towards those characters, would be kissing Riker. I totally believe that Patrick Stewart is kissing his old friend Jonathan Frakes, because he goes around kissing Ian McKellen on the lips every opportunity. He's very kind of touchy-feely guy. But then he's an actor. He's a lovey. You know, he's a kind of RSC lovey. And that is part of his personality. And that is not, to my mind, part of Captain Picard's personality, no matter however much he changes and however much we love that he's kind of got out of his sort of stiff upper lip, you know, thing from TNG. I just felt like in those moments, it's like, yeah, okay, Patrick Stewart's having fun on this show. Okay, that's great. But they slightly took me out of it.
Can I just push back on that for a second? Because two things. I've thought about the ridiculous French accent quite a bit. I disagree with you completely on the Riker thing. I think on the kiss, I genuinely believe that Picard could evolve to do that, and especially at that point in his life when he thinks he's dying. I bought that completely. I think you have a way more valid point. Exactly. I think you have a way more valid point about Stardust City Rag, but the way I explained it to myself, because it is extremely jarring, right? Extremely jarring. But it makes sense to me, and this is not me telling myself to like it, because I didn't love everything about it. What makes sense to me about his ridiculous French accent is that if Picard had to be put, Picard, not Patrick Stewart, if Jean-Luc Picard had to be put in a situation where he had to be outlandish in order to pass through, he wouldn't know how to do that, right? It's not, this isn't him pretending to be like a sinister archaeologist like in Gambit, like that, because that's almost like, you know, you could see him doing that. He's being put in a situation where he basically has to go to the most ridiculous, like, drag bar in Las Vegas, right? He has to fit in order to get through the door, basically, right? I totally bought that Picard wouldn't know how to do that, so the only way he would do that is by being completely ridiculous and over the top, because he has no other frame of reference. So, like, that to me, and I could see how people would, you know, not agree with me, but I genuinely bought it. I was like, this is how Picard thinks, like, a ridiculous, like, French gangster would be like, because he doesn't know how to act, he's Picard.
Well, that's a fair point, and I suppose, you know, we've seen many times that Picard is a terrible actor.
Yeah.
And it's kind of almost a running joke in Next Gen that, you know, Patrick Stewart is a, you know, probably the best actor they've ever had in Star Trek, and Picard is supposedly a lousy actor. I can see that. I just sort of feel like the way that Picard is bad as Dixon Hill is very different from the way that Picard is bad as, you know,
yeah,
Inspector Clouseau, or whoever he was in that episode.
Fair enough.
But, you know, all right, okay, I'll
watch it again
with
that
nice
in mind.
It's good to have an out, whether you buy it or not.
I agree completely. I agree completely.
On my next viewing, I'll try. I'll do my best. I think it would just help if I hadn't seen, you know, him doing the same character on the Graham Norton sofa the week before, you know.
Sure, we can go on about loads of other things. You know, we've barely touched on the Borg and so on, but time is escaping us. I want to just ask one thing of you all and stuff, just a quick one. Who's your sort of hidden gem or moment that you're kind of looking forward to revisiting and sort of your rewatch? For me, I thought, you know, Jeff Russo, you know, I wasn't too sure about the opening theme the first time I've heard it, but I've come to really adore and love that theme. And I've thought his use of kind of soundtracking, you know, his beautiful cover that he's done with Isa of Blue Skies. I think the soundtrack to, you know, Star Trek Picard has been absolutely fantastic, and I'm really looking forward to listening to it in isolation. I've kind of added Blue Skies onto the running playlist, so that's been a bit of a popular one the past week. But what are you guys looking forward to hearing or revisiting on your rewatch?
I can go first. I think there's a lot. I really did. I know we've been talking about things that we didn't like or didn't quite hit the mark, but I love this show. I really did. I'm still in awe that this thing fucking exists. It's amazing, right? You know, tell that to like 14 or 15 year old Carlos. Like, he would never have believed you. One of the things that stuck to me, which I think was, could have been fan service, and it wasn't, and it was beautiful, and it was everything I wanted it to be, and the reason why I love Stardust City Rag so much, is that scene between Picard and Seven, right before Seven leaves La Sirena. I thought that sequence where they each look at each other and they're honest with each other about the baggage that only the two of them know that they carry, right? I know that there are other XPs and things like that, but you know what I mean? Like, these are the only two main characters of Star Trek that have gone through this horrific physical, mental, emotional, I don't know what you want to call it, rape or, like, violation, right? And they're just sitting there. And it is, to me, one of the standout scenes. It's like 25, 30 years in the making for these two characters to come together. And it didn't disappoint. And even though the scene is only, like, from beginning to end 2 minutes, I thought that scene was absolutely spectacular. You know, we talk about the Marvel Cinematic Universe, you know, forget that. Like, the Star Trek Cinematic Universe is at play in Picard in such a wonderful way. And I thought that sequence was powerful and everything I wanted it to be. So I was just blown away, and I look forward to revisiting that scene over and over and over again.
For me, I think the main thing, to be honest, is I just can't wait to go back and watch this whole season in one go, to kind of binge it. And partly to be able to watch it without that kind of weight of expectations, without all that baggage. You know, not least on the level of, I think, when you're sort of wondering where's the story going to go, and you're spending, you know, even that last episode, you know, is Worf going to turn up on the Enterprise? Which is kind of what I feel like I was primed for by the end of Discovery season one. I kind of thought they were going to repeat that trick. You know, when you're spending the whole time anticipating things, it slightly gets in the way of absorbing the story that you are being given. So I'm kind of looking forward to going back, you know, knowing the kind of general shape of this story and watching it unfold without all these kind of myriad alternatives going on in my head about what might have happened or the plots that weren't taken one way or another. Just in terms of kind of individual elements that I think really stood out, I mean, I mentioned before, I thought the whole cast was wonderful. I think, you know, as Carlos said, Laris and Shaban absolutely kind of held their own opposite Patrick Stewart, who's obviously been playing this role for decades. You know, they felt as kind of lived in and as real. I think actually Issa Briones as well was a fantastic addition to the Star Trek universe. I mean, I thought that from that very first episode as Darge, I felt like she did an amazing job as, you know, a young performer to go in there and basically hold the episode jointly with Patrick Stewart. And I think she's great in the show. I mean, I know a lot of people had some issues with her and Narek and their storyline on the Cube. But I think that once she and Picard got together, once Soji and Picard got together, something kind of special happened, because that relationship was really strong and was really interesting. And I think that's one reason that a lot of people said Broken Pieces was their favourite episode, or one of their favourite episodes, because that's where you finally get the connection between these two characters who've sort of, he's been looking for her the whole time, but she doesn't even know he's been looking for her. So you get, her storyline feels a little bit like it's treading water, waiting for Picard to catch up. And I think once you get the two of them together, something special happens. And that's another reason why Nepenthe is so good. It's not all about Riker and Troy. Nepenthe is a great episode for Soji. She's fantastic in that episode, and for Kestra as well, you know, and that whole relationship works really well. So that's one of the things that I suppose I wasn't really expecting going into it from the beginning. I wasn't expecting that character to be so central to the story and that performance to be so strong and so engaging. And I'm kind of looking forward to going back and watching all the way through, you know, knowing sort of where these characters are going and you know, with a different, an ability to sort of focus on different things, I suppose, this time around.
So we've kind of come to the end of our sort of journey. Hopefully our climax has been sort of a better construction than the one we perhaps got with Picard. But Carlos, if people wanted to, you know, you've touched on some of the things that you've written. You're also quite a prolific Star Trek podcaster over on the Great Trek Ranks podcast. Where might people be able to check out some of your stuff, and what would you maybe recommend?
Well, thanks for that opportunity. Well, I write a lot for Trek News. And so if you go to Trek News and you search for me, you'll find all sorts of articles that I've written for them. And I'm obviously on Twitter. I love Star Trek Twitter. It's my favorite thing. I use it to relax all the time. So my handle is @DoubleMac, M-A-C-C, which because I also I drink a lot of espresso, and Double Macchiato is my go-to. So catch me on Twitter.
And what about for yourself, Duncan? You're a Star Trek podcaster, writer yourself. You've got all the credentials. Where can people kind of check out your work?
Well, you can find me, if you want to get in touch, you can find me on Twitter at Barrett's Books. That's B-A-R-R-E-T-T. If you're interested in Star Trek and history and literary culture, I host a show on the Trek FM podcast network called Primitive Culture, which looks at historical and cultural inspiration for Star Trek's writers principally. If you're interested in my thoughts on Star Trek Picard, as you mentioned, I have a piece that just went up quite recently on the official Star Trek website, where you can read a little bit about my kind of thoughts on the show, you know, really from the kind of first half of the season, really kind of going into it, going to the premiere, and the kind of impact of that on my kind of fandom as a, you know, many decades long Next Gen fan.
Well, thank you guys for joining me, and thank you to everyone for listening. Hopefully it's nothing but blue skies from now on.